From dimensioning men, and I'll explain to you, from dimensioning men is not its disease. Never mind. All the slaughters and all the theories about fear. Man is not the three beings, fundamentally. I've never seen this in man. At the physiological level, man is a composite being. They can ask me, who is man? What is man? How does his humanity express itself? In what sense is it different from the animal in the field? From the beast? In the forest? So I'll tell you, all creatures are not confronted beings. Men are confronted beings. He is an opposed being, he is a challenged being. He is a prisoner of the natural law and the social institutions. Man is not free because he is insecure. Disaster may strike at any moment. You can never know whether disaster will or not strike the next second. He is subject to 101 restrictive measures, some due to his being a natural creature, some are a result of his social integration. As a matter of fact, the more powerful the person is, the more restricted he is. If you ask me who has little freedom, I'll tell you the President of the United States. Oh, I believe there's someone who is more of a prisoner than he, it is the ruler of the world. Where are you, then? Pleasure to follow. Man is a social animal, and he cares for public opinion. What is good? What is good matter men do? Anything, even sacrifice life in order to win favor in the eyes of the public. The craze of the public calls for the whole public opinion about his every individual, whether the public likes him or doesn't like him. Now about the phobia of this people. Hence, even those who are legally free men, those who are not slaves, are in bondage to nature, to society, to a hundred restrictive phobias, superstitions and prejudices, morals and customs. There is no free man. There is only one way how man can free himself from all restrictions, from all his fears, from all his phobias. From all his, frights, was only one way. By surrender to God. Surrender to God frees man from his serfdom to his soulmate, to nature. Take for instance, in antiquity, man was afraid of one disease, and that was leprosy. Man was afraid. This scepter of leprosy haunted man in antiquity. This was the incurable disease. Modern man has not won freedom from such a fright. It's not leprosy now, it's cancer. How many people are simply insane? Because of doubt in their mind, because of the fright, perhaps they'll develop malignancy. Will you call modern man free? He is not free. Because as I said before, free is only the person who is not frightened. The frightened person cannot be free. Terror, fright, is the worst prison. It means captivity for man. How can men get rid of his fright? There's only one way. If you surrender to God. If there is faith in God, then surrender to Him. It's a great fright, of course. You have to be afraid of God too. You have to fear God. But you know well that a great fright, a terror, frees men from evil terrors, from evil frights. And that's why to surrender to God not mean to give up my freedom. I don't give up my freedom for one short while, for a few seconds. It's very hard. The biological pressures are being pushed. And nature, the color blood, summons action. And it happens that the particular action has been prohibited by the law, be it in the realm of dietary law, be it in the realm of sex morality, has been prohibited. All man has to do is to exert his ability to give up freedom for a few seconds. And the next hour will find freedom at a high level, exalted and enhanced, and he will be more of a free man than he was before. Vayitzeinu, Ad Hashem in Mitzrayim, if we had been taken out of Egypt, without committing, without accepting his call, without surrendering his authority, without reaching the covenant with him, without obligating ourselves to surrender freedom in order to gain a higher form of freedom, then we would be in bondage again. Bondage to whom? To nature, to our own fears, to our own phobias, to society, to struggles, not only because the Redeemer was not just a man, but an Elohim. That's why we celebrate Pesach. And Pesach is a festival of freedom. Now let's two more. Beyot Chazoko and Israel Itula. With a strong hand and outstretched arm. Of course, you know very well the Jewish ethics, Jewish morality, is based upon one principle, upon one foundation. What's the foundation? One after the law. To imitate, I mean, it's very difficult term to be used, but for the sake, for the lack of another term, we call it imitate, run. It is also an expression, be dominant. We have to imitate his ways, his actions, since in Itachio Bini is the very foundation of our ethic. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu used Yot HaZoko, Israel Etula, we are also supposed to use it from time to time. When in times of crisis, or in times of distress, or whenever the call comes through to stand up and to defend a certain position. What does it mean, Yot HaZoko? What do the terms Yot HaZoko, Israel Etula mean? As far as Jewish morality is concerned, as far as human beings are concerned, what Kavi is supposed to do and how Kavi is supposed to execute our plans. If we are called upon to intervene in this type of situation and to act. Of course, Yom Chazoko, who is it? Yom Chazoko and Vrei Metuyo mean two things. Effectiveness, effective action. Is it Yot Chazoko? Who's really clear what does it mean when you say Israel at Leo? What is Israel to the Heret from Yodi? How does he from Yodi with 2 years out of the Shalai? What does it mean? It means vigilance, watchfulness, alertness, being ready, being prepared. What comes to expression is the idea that man is a responsible being. Responsibility is a part of his divine endowment. Yet, and that Yahavis has taught us time and again, his responsibility is not limited to his own actions. Of course, he's certainly responsible for his own actions, to his own individual behavior. Man is charged with historical responsibility. If you want, you can use the phrase of Kol Yisrael Avedim Zavodah. But if you, man was called upon, as I said before, to shape history, to be historically involved, to direct historical unfolding toward worthwhile objectives. We know in the Halacha, there are two groups of mitzvahs, mitzvahs of Tzibur, mitzvahs of Yochid. Men's activism initiative within the historical drama is the foundation of the others. The Yochid individual was called upon from time to time to participate in the emergence and development of the necessity soul. In order to participate in the historical drama, one must possess two capabilities. First, to be always ready for action. Second, when action is called for, to act effectively. Zayan Ephina with an outstretched arm, symbolizes the state of vigilance and watchfulness. Vigilance, actually, can be broken down into two component parts. First of all, totally wrong. Who is vigilant? Who is vigilant? Who is watchful? Watchful is the mother when our baby is sick. Not a stranger, but watchful. In order to be watchful, to be vigilant, one must be completely dedicated, totally dedicated. Partial commitment does not result in steady concern and in steady worry. But these are the two cornerstones of vigilance, the state of mind which motivates man to be watchful, alert, and keen. Where do you have a case in Tanakh of someone being vigilant, watchful? This is the ideal. If the Tanakh, if the Bible portrays such a person, it means he personified vigilance at its best. Who is it? Who are they? Who? Mordechai was alert on the guard as soon as Esther was taken away from his. To the royal palace. Do you know why was Mordechai? Was he right? Why was Mordechai born? Because he loved her. He was devoted to her, and he was unreservedly committed to her, the power of Mordechai and us. A wise father or mother is at the same time a vigilant father or mother. But children sometimes, they don't run by their father or their mother, so they're not always vigilant. God against danger is only the person who is committed, totally, unconditionally. You cannot be alert, you cannot alert an individual to danger unless he is concerned, he is the concerned individual. And basically what we need now, the Jewish community, the Orthodox community in general, the Jewish community in general vis-à-vis of Israel, of course, but the Orthodox community in particular vis-à-vis in preservation of Yehudis, preservation of Terem throughout the United States, is vigilance. But vigilance is a function of total concern. Whoever is not concerned totally is not vigilant. And whoever is not vigilant will always miss the opportunity. He will come in a bit late. You will not act at the opportune moment. This is number one. Number two, it is not enough to be vigilant, means not only to be concerned or something else. It's not enough to be attentive. One must possess historical intuition, sensitivity to events, a sense of discrimination between peripheral and central occurrences. Some people can discriminate. To them, a marginal event is very important, and a central event they don't see. We need sometimes at least a spark of the clairvoyance of the prophet in order to know when to intervene and when to wait. Again, I have to refer to more. Mordechai was not only concerned, and that was the reason for his being vigilant and attentive and aware. Mordechai had that sensitivity to history. He felt the heartbeat, the rhythm of his historical drama. And he knew when to act and not act. Mordechai possessed the prescience and the foresight indispensable for commission decisions. Esther thought, for instance, what was this controversy between him and Esther? What was the controversy? The messages were flying back and forth between Esther and Mordecai by a talk. You are talking what I don't know. Mr. Lisa Malachi, eunuch for the king, held the heaven. Whoever persons whose Esther entrusted him with the mission are persuading Mordecai. Yeah. What was the controversy between Mordecai and Esther? They disagreed about something. To such an extent that Mordecai sent her the fiery warning. You must be stachrishi vaisa zeis. You need air vaisa zeis to God from others. What was the crux of the controversy? Esther thought that her intervention should be delayed. For simple reason. She explained her opinion. She said, very well, she has not been summoned to appear before the king. There is a law in the statute books of Persia and Mordecai that whoever appears in the inner courtyard or main without receiving invitation from the kingdom should be executed. So she'll appear before the king, she might be executed. And she didn't care so much for her life. But then, what will the poor Mordecai do? What will the Jews do, There'll be no one to intervene, but to intercede on behalf of the people who are condemned to death. So she advised Mordecai that it would be rather advisable. After all, the edict of extermination was just issued. The extermination was delayed for almost a year. The edicts were issued before Pesach. And the extermination of the Jews was supposed to take place when? On the 13th, correct? On the 13th of Adar. So there are almost 11 months. So she advised him, and wisely advised him. Why rationale? Why violate to the king? Because there's a question of whether she'll succeed to sin. She might be killed with the person approaching. So let us delay action for another month. Then, over such a period of time, she'll certainly receive invitation, and then she'll come in, she'll be secure, so she'll intervene. And Mordecai apparently, without explaining why he's opposed, the message, the warning, and Mordecai insisted that instant action without delay be taken. And of course, he was right. That he was right, that's the proof that she succeeded in her mission. Mordecai had a sensitivity. Sometimes one is sensitive to events. And he knows that he has to act now. Cannot explain basically why. Many times, and I want you to understand, it's easy to explain, to rationalize, secondary, marginal decisions. Yes. Why did you buy this stuff? Why did you buy this stuff? I don't know the issues. So you can rationalize. But if one will ask you, why do you love a certain person? Why are you committed to certain ideal? Why do you sacrifice your life for certain ends? You cannot rationalize, you cannot explain. Central decisions, crucial decisions which decide the destiny of the human being, or sometimes the destiny of the people, the destiny of the community, can never be explained. I feel like doing it, also an intuitive, so to say, certain, a light goes on before me, and I see the road along which I have to travel. I cannot explain, I have no compass. I'll just go to the dark. But I'm sure that I'll get to the objective, to my destination. I'm sure. If I'm called to account rationally, I cannot account. This is basically it. And the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim says, Shuvi Shuvi Ashulamis, Shuvi Shuvi V'Nechasevach. So the Rebbe says, Eurim Eurim Umis Eurim, the Knesset Yisrael, the Gentile peoples, address themselves to the community of Israel, the Knesset Israel, Shuvi Shuvi Hashem, come back to us. Why such dedication? Why such commitment? Why so many sacrifices? Why so much torture and misery and agony? For God, who left you in exile with this attitude, who retreated into his transcendental hiding abode, why, the Nazis then, and will appoint you Duxin, princes, and rulers. So Father Shalami, who might be a Jew? Even visiting the Nazis royal, with all the victories, it's more convenient, the more comfortable to be a boy. Why be a Jew? Why? Shuvi Shuvi Hashem. Drop your madness, your mad love. Your anonymous dedication. Your unlimited commitment. Or what? So what does she answer? Matkecha Zubashulani is confidence on my family. What can I tell you? I'm just involved in the dance between two camels. I cannot free myself from the dance. You know why be a Jew? Because one cannot be a non-Jew. He has to be a Jew. There's no answer to that. It's an eternal commitment. It's a commitment which is a part of my identity. It's a part of my own existence. Can I explain my own existence? Who I am? Why I want to live? Why I am afraid of death, my relationship to my children, my relationship to my parents. Can I explain my basic experiences? I cannot explain. That's why I cannot explain the experience of being a Jew. It's a basic experience. It is the central experience. A central experience cannot be rationalized, nor can it be explained in experimental words. You ask me, why did Mordechai tell Esther? Why did he ignore his theological arguments? He felt like doing that. He couldn't explain it. But he felt, now is the time. In a week from now, in a month from now, it will be too late. This is the historical sensitivity. Matech is in Vashon Lamos, in Chilas Hashem. It's an eternal dance on which no one can sleep. He has to dance and continue dancing until Bayimahu, near the Shemachot, Ushmeachot. This is vigilance, concern, and historical sensitivity. Now, of course, when man feels to intervene, he must do it effectively. Half measures which do not produce results should not be undertaken at all. That was the way the Jews always acted. They knew how and when they were concerned. When they did it, they acted effectively. Now I will conclude the Hebrew, I feel to love the Chachamim, to love the Levim, to love the Zkenim, to love the Yidin Satero, Mitzvah Reino Lesater Vitzias Mitzrayim, וכל המעבר לסתר וציאס מצרים, הרי זה משובח. אבל אפילו כולנו חכמים, כולנו נביאים, כולנו סגירים, ויצא לצומן לקיים, the subject to two interpretations. One interpretation will use the subjunctive, the other interpretation will use the indicative, the grammatical indicative. One interpretation will say, will interpret, or rather translate, Afilu kolonu chachamim, even if we were, if all of us were wise, Afilu kolonu nevenim, even if all of us, if everybody were the subjunctive, I mean intelligent, kolonu skenim, even if everyone where a scholar and so forth, it would be duty bound to tell the story of the time, the subjunctive. But actually the Hebrew text, of course, the Hebrew text is very hard to know. The indicative and the subjunctive many times may appear on the same, use the same vocabulary. But it's quite attempting to interpret a Pinukamanuta from him, Kolonanabhinya, Kolonanaskanya, in the indicative. Even though we are, not if we were. Even though you are Sakonin, we are Nabhinya, we are Zakanya, we are bound, duty bound, to tell the story of its life. Which interpretation do you like to choose on here? Then you can exercise an option. Which one would you like to prefer? The subjunctive or the indicative? What do you say? I can't hear you. The right one?
Yes,
the right one. The right one is the right one is the indicative. The right one is that we are not speaking about something doubtful, hypothetical, but we are speaking about something real. If it is subjunctive, so you don't understand why is it necessary to say. If it's just subjunctive, we were, and actually indeed we are not, so why is it necessary to say that we are bound to tell the story of Mitzvah? If we mean it in a genuine sense, that we are, even though we are scholars, we are wise, we are learned, we are familiar with the laws, nevertheless, we are bound to tell the story of Mitzrayim, then it makes sense. But all the question is, if it's used in the indicative form, does it smell a bit of pride, vainglory? How can a Jew say of himself, as in Kolonu Chachomim, Kolonu Nevenim, Kolonu Skin, Kolonu Yedim Sateh? And it's a lie. That's exactly what I want just to comment on that. If the second shot, the form is that of the indicative, not the subjunctive. As I said before, I believe that the indicative form is applicable as well as the subjunctive. Sifri Yetzias Mitzrayim is identical with Limud, as I said before. This study is a discourse, this medrash. We do not read the sections in Exodus. The best proof is that we do not read the sections in Exodus. Doing the Yetzias Mitzrayim, but we interpret a section in Dvarim, Rami Dvarim, pertaining to single events that occur in Mitzrayim, and so it means we just study the meaning of certain words, but we don't tell a complete tale. The tale is far from being complete the way we present it in Dvarim. If we wanted to tell a complete tale covering all angles, there was only one way to start with the Shmuel Yisrael Boy Mitzrayim out, to read through Vayero and Bay, and finish Bay, and if we want to tell the story of Kriyas Yam Suf, so we have to read half of Bishalach until Ani Yad Shem Rechel. But we don't do that. What we mention about it is Mitzrayim, which are just the highlights. And we are interested not so much in the event as in the interpretation of the words of Avraham Eivedoi. As the Rambam calls it, the Mishnah says, V'derech HaPar Shapuro, and the Rambam calls it Medrash. Simply, we learn, we investigate, we explore, we study. It signifies exploration, investigation, analysis, etc. And as I have explained many times, I don't know whether I did it here or not, but in Moriah Sefer, basically Sifri Yetzias Mitzrayim cannot be separated from Talmud Erech. Sifri Yetzias Mitzrayim, as far as the gist of the mitzvah is concerned, is inseparably linked up with Talmud Erech. It's simply to study Torah, either Halachos or the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on the night, on the 15th night in Israel. It's basically a mitzvah Talmud Erech. Since the Torah has prepared chashivas, has prepared chuvas to the questions of the four sons, yes, including the Dal and the insensitive one, it is obvious that what did the Torah want? What is obvious? The Torah has prepared answers, chuvas. To be given beginning with the scholarly self, the wicked self, the dull self, and the insensitive, which it doesn't inquire at all. And as I explained it in Maria last night, it's four different truths, I mean, in terms of prayer. However, there is a common denominator in all of this. What is the common denominator? Start living therapy. To tell the tree of Mitzrayim is to teach yourself. Teach him about Mitzrayim, teach him about the laws pertaining to Pesach, but to tell the Tavukol Levincha means the Limadukol Levincha. With a Daiki Shobain, all is Melambe. It's Tavukol. It is obvious that everyone, no matter how ignorant, no matter how alienated, has a share in the temple. Every Jew is endowed with a potential, basically. Basically, every Jew is endowed with a potential of them to understand, to comprehend, and to digest them. I say it once. You know the Gemara about Rabbi Simoi, who said that the embryo, while he's in the womb of the mother, is taught by an angel, taught Taylor by an angel, and then when he's about to depart, so the Malach slaps him on his face, and he forgets it. So the pressure is an obvious one. All Chachma Drusha, why teach and then slap him on his face? He should forget. Mimanusha, either or. If you don't want him to know, don't teach him. If you taught him, why should he forget? The answer is, why should forget? It's a very serious question. Why should forget? The answer is simple. Torah must be acquired through idea, through work, through dedication, through study. Torah is not a gift to each, it's just granted. It's not a ready-made suit which one just walks into the store and puts on. Without idea, there is no Torah. That's why. So the question is, alright, if without idea, should just be reminiscing. Remember. You know, Plato said that all learning is just to remember. But we are saying Torah learning is to remember. Why should Torah learning is not something new? The Jew is not something strange to the Jew, something new. They approach a child, he begin to teach him how to say his Gimel Dalet, the operation of the Gimel Shmaya Zohar, he didn't something new thing. He knew it once upon a time. You begin to remind him. You know, sometimes we forget an event, and we are reminded by someone. And little by little, we are beginning to reproduce. Torah learning is reproduction by the memory. Why should it be reproduction by the memory and not comprehension? For a simple reason. Because it's not alien. Since I knew it once, it's not alien to me anymore. I have the potential. Of course, it's latent in me, but I can reproduce it. So it means every Jew can be a great scholar. Every Jew can be a chacham. Every Jew can attain the bio. Every Jew can attain the art. The potential of Torah is present in the Jew. And even one has failed to take advantage, to realize the gifts that God bestowed upon him, everyone is entitled to a share in the Torah, to the intuitive perceptibility of Torah verities. And then everyone is able to comprehend a Torah thought if explained and expounded by a good teacher. And everyone knows, more or less, to implement Torah laws, no matter how often he has to consult the Rebbe or the Rabbi. Torah is not the possession of a few. Here is the possession of the entire Knesset Yisrael, the entire congregation. If there has ever been a democratic philosophy of chinuch, of education, if there has ever been an exoteric philosophy of education, it is powerful of education. Think education in Greece was esoteric. To the Plato Academy, they did not admit everybody. They just admitted a few. During the Middle Ages, education and knowledge was controlled, you know, by the order, by the monastic orders. I mean, in England, knowledge universities, the oldest university, Oxford, Cambridge, We are controlled by a few and we are accessible just to the aristocracy. In effect, now people begin to realize that everybody is entitled to education. It's a question of helping those who cannot attain it by themselves. Our system of education was democratic from its very beginning. It's democratic, exoteric. Whoever wants to study, whoever wants admission, was let in, was provided with the opportunity, given the opportunity to study. Why? Why did we develop such a democratic approach to Chinuch, to the dissemination of Torah knowledge, to providing everybody with the opportunity of studying and acquiring knowledge? Why? Because the Torah is not something which is outside of the Jew, but which resides in the Jew. Sometimes he's conscious of it, sometimes he's unconscious. But in the deep recesses of his personality, there will be knowledge of Torah, there will be intuition of Torah, and there will be sensitivity to Torah beings. And Pesach night, and that is symbolized by the Seder. Pesach night, which is the restaging and the reenacting of the drama of Exodus, at which every Jew beheld Gimish Fine. Pesach night something happened which we are unaware of. Not only the Jews left Mitzrayim, but Pesach night the Jews were confronted by the Shechinah, who the male of God was a Gimish Shechinah, who are accustomed to say that Gimish Shechinah was a public spectacle as a direct thing. They came in a way, correct. But the way they are going to write, the same drama was staged. And Pesach night, in the male body of the Jewish thing, that means everyone suddenly, for 1 minute or 1 hour, because of Pesach night, was wise and clever and intelligent and sensitive and filled with presence of God. But otherwise, it would be no exodus. And I told you, when he said, in addition, I came in the male body, and for 1 hour or two, he was initiated into the greatest of all mysteries, and was considered a Chacham Novi Baldeir. Permission was granted that night to all of us to address ourselves as Chachomi in the Reini Mustaniya. And it was Baldeir Vadeirachai, Vadam Nirvisatsmi, Kimliyat Mitzrayim. And those Jews who left Mitzrayim were confronted with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So is each Jew. So is each Jew and every Seder table confronted with Gimel Shechinah. In Yerushalayim, no matter how ignorant he is, the point of Chochmah and Noreh and Zochin is there.